two very foundational things. So the one thing is that whenever we're working on something and you're doing something in product, it's always about finding this balance between the build trap, but then also on the other hand, analysis paralysis.
Welcome to the Scandinavian Product Podcast. My guest today is Ida Olin. Ida is both a good friend and a great product mind from Norway. If you are a product manager or a leader in Norway, I bet you have heard about Ida's work. She's the author of the first Norwegian product management book called Bedre Produkter, which directly translates to Better Products. She's been a product coach for the past year before joining NAV recently as a product lead. Ida and I talked about how writing helps us think, how to find the balance between the build trap and analysis paralysis, how to use assumption mapping to avoid getting stuck, using health metrics and OKRs to help us stay focused on the most important things, and more. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you do, please don't forget to leave a good review and share it, as it really helps the podcast grow. To our surprise, it's already ranked number 2 in technology podcasts in Norway, which is pretty crazy. All right, enough of bragging. I now bring you Ida Olin.
All right, Ida, we're live. Welcome. And it's really nice to see you. It's been a while. We haven't talked for a few weeks. It's always really nice to talk to you. But you've launched the only book in Norwegian for product management. So how does it feel to be the product sensation in Norway these days?
It's a bit weird to think about, because I remember when I pitched the book, it was in the, I guess it must have been the summer of 22. I told my editor, I'm not sure the market is there yet, but I'm sure the market for this book will come eventually. So if we do it now, then we'll be that book when the market eventually comes. So I have to admit that I was pleasantly surprised to learn that it was indeed the market already, and kind of had no idea how many would actually be interested in reading something in Norwegian about product management or just product thinking in general. So that was it was a pleasant surprise, actually. I wasn't the only one that was like thinking, I need to kind of make this stuff make sense in my context. Yeah.
So what has basically inspired you to even start thinking about this? Like, what made you reflect that, okay, we need a book in a region on product management?
I started, I've actually written 3 books before. They're here, very conveniently placed in the, but they're all media, kind of. So they're like, so I've done writing before. And what I like with writing is that it helps you think. It helps you kind of, if you only consume stuff, it can give you ideas and inspiration, but to really figure out how does it all connect, how do I think about it, how do I understand it, it really helps to have to explain it to someone else. And in a book, you have to make a very coherent presentation of it, because it's so long, you know, and you really need to make all the pieces play together and not be completely contradictory, although some contradictions are okay. Of course, that's life, but as you also know, product is full of contradictions. So I kind of had done that. And then the very honest answer also is that the summer of 2022, I was very burned out. I kind of, at the time, I was so ill, I thought I'd probably never be able to have a job again, a proper job. I was very low. But I realized that people are different. You need to treat burnout in a way that doesn't stress you. But what I realized that I wouldn't be getting better by just, I don't know, doing yoga or staring at the walls. I'm a person, I need to do something. And then a lot of people would sound weird, like, oh, you treat burnout with writing books? That sounds stressful. But the nice thing with a book is, if you just give up halfway, doesn't have any consequences, doesn't matter. You don't have anybody, you're writing a book, so there's that. They don't, for a book like this, nobody's paying you in advance anyway. So nobody's losing money. And so like, and in terms of if you yourself feel like, oh, it's wasted time, then you might have the wrong motivation to write a book in the first place. Because for me, like, I want to think about things and I read things and think about them. And I've got to do that anyway. So yeah, that's kind of how it started. It was more like, but the topic
I think
was...
I think we're very similar in that, like the process of writing helps you reflect and is, at least it seems to me from our conversations before, that it's also a place to relax. It's just you and your book, basically. It's almost meditating in a way.
Yeah.
So so that's good. But like, but you did mention, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, like it's sort of like a puzzle, you know? You need to figure it out somehow. Like, what is the next sentence? What do I actually mean? Like, if the sentence is so vague, it's because I haven't understood it yet or because I haven't made up my mind. And it kind of forces you to, you know, be clearer about things and make your mind up, which is healthy, I think.
Yeah. How do you deal with... So one thing I struggle with sometimes is when I'm writing, is sometimes I go in that rabbit hole of trying to articulate myself in a bit more clear way. But then sometimes I reach sort of a wall and I feel, I can't really get this thought out or kind of craft it in the way I want it. And the way I deal with it is just sometimes just go for a walk a little bit or relax or just, do something else and then come back to it. Do you have any tricks? What's your process when you sort of hit the wall, basically, in your writing process?
So one thing is it's actually just time. So instead of like, if you have this little piece or paragraph or sentence that you're stuck with, sometimes I just write to myself in like caps lock, clarify this or like fix this. And I'm just like, okay, I'll get there the next time. So often I think for this book, I've kind of wrote through the whole book, maybe like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times sort of. The first time is like super drafty, and then, but you keep moving, and then you just start from the start again, and then it becomes, you kind of, it's kind of like having, I always think about it like a comb, but the comb gets finer and finer. At first it's like really coarse and you drag through it, and then it gets finer, and you like get all of the last little, that's knots out.
Yeah.
You need to like start with the like really big, like, does it even make sense to do like this topic before that topic, sort of? And then later on, you can be like this sentence. And then also one thing that's like, if you can't really find a way to say it, often just like, well, does it need to be said at all? Maybe you can just edit it out and just be like, somebody else will say it better at the later time, or it has already been said better than I can do it, and just like, leave it out. Like, you don't need to cover everything. If it becomes unreadable and way too long.
Yeah, I love that. I like to, when I feel that there is someone that has said it so much, so much better before, yeah, I just like to quote them, basically. Yeah. It's just so much easier. I think there's a lot of authors who try to kind of, have their take on every single thing. Well, just sometimes just quote them is so much more powerful. And it's great. It's great that you're, kind of referencing each other's work. But your book is, back to something you said before, it is covering something very complex, like product management. It is easy, but it's complex. There's a lot of context and there's no one right way of doing things. So your book is called Better Products. So Ida, tell us a little bit, what do we need to do to actually build better products?
Oh, wow, good question. I shouldn't be supposed to answer that. Maybe if I be like, wait, what did I write? I mean, the thing is, when a book comes out, everybody wants to talk to you about your book and like, what did you learn? But the actual process of producing a book means that I stopped writing this thing back in July 2023. It's ages ago. Who knows what is said in this book? but it's
good. If you had to pick one thing that Yeah, so it comes to mind when you think about better products. What would that be, or a couple of things that you've found to be extremely common within successful and happy product teams?
I think the core thing, there are two things that feel very foundational for me, and which are always, that seems to be true in every industry, in every context. These are the only two things that I can't come up with examples of, like, exceptions where this isn't true. And these are not my concepts, but it just, from the examples I've given on the different settings I've talked about, it are two very foundational things. So the one thing is that whenever we're working on something and you're doing something in product, it's always about finding this balance between the build trap, but then also on the other hand, analysis paralysis. So in Norwegian, I've just called it analysefella and byggefella. But there's, like, whenever something has been a waste of time, which is like when product is going wrong, either you just sat and thought too hard about it, or thought too hard about the wrong part of the problem, or you built for too long, kind of before you were checking your assumptions. So much of it is like knowing when to stop building and knowing when to start building, knowing when to think more and experiment more and analyze more, and also knowing when, like, you know, this shit is good enough. Let's just get something out. It needs to meet people. That's this extremely foundational thing, and which is a thing that's very different from the way when you thought build things in projects, because eventually you get the thing done, get it built, and which is something that's, for people who haven't been in product for so long, it really takes a long time to kind of recognize both of those traps and avoid both of them. It's often this pendulum, like after people build something and then they realize, oh, it's the wrong thing, we built the wrong thing, or nobody was. They were like, next time we're going to do it right. And then they just, like, it way too much, like, research and plans and the business cases and whatever. And then just there are assumptions there. So even did you did all the analysis, end up building the wrong thing afterwards. And just this, yeah, very fine balance.
I have seen that quite a few times. Like, both traps, but more so the discovery trap, the analysis paralysis. Yeah. Like, people just go on forever and forever and forever, and then all of a sudden it's been like 6 months, and okay, what have you learned, and what have you shipped, what type of value have you added to your customers and created for your business? And it's like, well, we haven't really done anything apart from 100,000 user interviews.
Yeah, and for me, it's kind of, they're sort of like, I'm just gonna, for those who aren't watching, I'm just drawing a little arrow with pointers on each set, and okay, here's the camera. It's sort of, me, is they're both ends of a spectrum, the analysis paralysis and the build trap. And the thing is, that seems very like an aha moment that people need to unlock, because often when you might say, like, you know, some disciplines are more eager to analyze and other disciplines are more eager to build or whatever, or like we have these dispositions, but the analysis paralysis versus the build trap as these ends of a spectrum makes it clear, like, it's not like any of them are better places to be. Both of them are bad places to be because you're not delivering any value. It doesn't matter to any customer or user, and if it doesn't matter to any customer or user, it will never matter to the business, because, like, you, if nobody's touching the thing, using the thing, you know, it's impossible to impact the business as well. So, and because that's what often happens in when people disagree about the things, it becomes like sort of maybe like a turf war between different disciplines. Like, oh, the designers just want to go on forever and injure you. Or like, oh, the developers just go ahead and just build random shit. And it's like, no, that's not what's going on. It's just like, you need to have both of those instincts, but you need to balance them. And that's why I'm, but as you can probably tell, I'm a very strong believer in this, like, more cross-functional team way of working. Some even go into the product manager as like this hero that makes everything happen. I don't think.
I totally agree with that. So for folks struggling with analysis paralysis these days, what do you think are some of the practical tips and tricks that you would tell them?
Yeah, so, well, usually when we realize we've been in the build trap, like we built the wrong thing or a thing that didn't work, it's usually because we've assumed something and we didn't really think about it. We're like, we've taken something for granted that we couldn't really take for granted. And then the analysis paralysis, on the other hand, you kind of try to think about everything and be sure about everything beforehand before you go and do anything, because you want to be like really sure. And then usually you overlook things then as well. So this concept of, which again is not my invention at all, I'm just like retelling things I learned from other people about assumptions, identifying assumptions. And maybe this was in Teresa Torres' book. I'm not sure. The assumptions part is in her book. And she's talking about risk assumption. And other people also do that. But a thing that at least like came clear to me when thinking about the different quadrants, when typically when you think about, okay, I'm going to need to wind back a little bit. So the thing is, very often on a team, when people argue about things, we love to use this word important. And I think people use the word important too much when they argue, because then we argue about what is the important thing to work on right now, what is an important thing to figure out. And everybody agrees, of course, that we should be doing important things and not unimportant things. So then you just try to make your thing the important thing. And but that's just like one of the axes. The other axis in terms of thinking about the assumptions is, you know, uncertainty or like confidence, or like how confident are we could actually figure this thing out. And this is the part I'm not sure if I stole from someone or I thought it myself. This is the next part, but you know, that's kind of what happens with writing. But the thing is, it's so, maybe it is Teresa Torres, I don't know, but it makes so much sense to me, is the natural place for us to go when we're starting on a new thing, especially a fussy and furry thing, are those things that we know are important, but we also know how to approach them, you know? Because then you're like, oh, we're getting started. Like for me, for instance, my background is as a UX designer. So usability problem is something that I like, I thrive with those problems. It feels like there's no usability problem you could throw at me and I wouldn't be able to solve it, kind of. That's my, at least like I have this confidence. So that's a good place to start. You're like, you can write your to-do list and start checking things off the list right away. We kind of gravitate towards those things that are important because you can see how they're necessary for the success. But they're not really that risky, exactly because you know how they're solvable. Solvable important things are those we gravitate to, but you can spend months on solvable important things and then never touch things that are way more risky, and it's natural to avoid them because like, I don't know. We should probably do something about that, but I'm like, I don't know. Well, what I want to underscore is that in most parts of life, you know, is that starting on these things that you know are important for the success of something and you also know how to approach is a very good idea. It's how I wrote my book. It's how I advise people to write. Just get started with the chapter you know how to write and then you'll get rolling. And then, you know, you leave the harder parts for later and just figure it out, because then probably you've been doing some thinking while you did the easier thing. I mean, in so many, if you write a thesis, you know, if we're gonna go on vacation for a month and it's like, oh, I don't know what to pack, well, just start with the stuff you know you're gonna bring anyway, and you're like, let's start. It's a natural thing and rational thing to do in most parts of life, and which is why people do it. It's not because they're stupid, it's just because they want to get started and get shit done, which is a good thing, right? They start with all these things that are not necessarily risky, but then we have just pushed the risk ahead of us.
Right. So then the X that you were describing, important and important, and the other one is?
Yeah, so in one axis, so unimportant versus more important, and the other one is confidence, or like the degree of certainness or something. And you know,
okay, so then
you're confident in an area and you know it's important, they're just like, oh, I get to do shit that I'm good at and which is important. It feels good. Everybody wants a work day like that when you know it's important and you kind of get this feeling of mastery. Who would want a work day like that? And that's the pleasant thing is like your troubles are usually somewhere about something you don't want to think about. We're just like, I don't want to think about that. Oh, let's think about that next week. And then you never do it. And then, you know, it turns out the whole thing was due from the start. I liked when I talk about these things, I think it's important to underscore that when we're doing things wrong, usually we're doing things that kind of make sense. You know, like doing the wrong thing, like when we actually do the wrong thing, it's because it feels like the right thing. If it would feel wrong, we wouldn't do it, right? So I feel like this also reminds me, like when I go in the mountains with my husband, and we, you know, like up in the mountains in Norway where you have like not very well marked routes. He's like, and then I ask him, like, are you sure we're on the right track? And he's like, yeah, this looks like a track, you know, yeah. I'm like, no, but that's when you take the wrong step. It's when you feel confident, but you haven't actually. And then like, because then I'm like, where's the evidence? Where's that little T mark, you know, the little wall on top of each other? So it's kind of like this thing that you don't go, is when you're confused about the road, then you're paying attention. You're like, is it this way or that way? And then you start reasoning. But you just like walk along. That's when you realize, fuck, we're lost. How long have we lost? It's like 10 minutes, 1 hour, or like where are we even? And I think I just and it's the thing, the same thing with the analysis paralysis and the bell trap. I mean, and Melissa Perry describes the bell trap very well, in a very like therapeutic way, because you can, when she write about it, you can think about all your stupid bosses or stupid colleagues that put you in the bell trap, kind of, and in that way it's like very therapeutic. But I think that mostly when we're in the bell trap or in the analysis paralysis, it doesn't feel wrong. It feels right at the time, but it actually isn't. And I think this is kind of like core to changing people's way of thinking, is that you kind of need to, you can't, I don't know exactly what my point is, but it's like we make missteps when we think we're doing the obvious right thing.
Yeah.
Not and double checking or asking critical questions. We're just like going for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And basically assumption mapping is something that helps us with that, avoiding analysis paralysis, because then we are questioning ourselves as a team. What are the things we have evidence and no evidence on? What are the actually important things? And then having those discussions as a team, as you said, like highlighting that cross-functional aspect.
And also people from outside the team, because there are things that maybe the team doesn't worry about at all, but someone, you know, legal is like, oh, okay, I don't like the sound of that. And then we're like, oh, no, oh, let's not bring in legal. It's just going to be a lot of fuss. You ask all these questions. Just be like, no, let's just leave that for later. And leave for later, that's when you realize, oh, we spent 6 months on this feature, but it's not really possible to make it compliant, you know, in the way that we dreamed up this thing. And it's like, if you had just brought in the grumpy lawyer earlier, they would need to get grumpy. They should maybe contribute.
I love that. That is spot on. I actually had one person asking me in... was having like a panel discussion, and one person in the audience asked this, so when is it a good time to bring in legal? And the answer was, well, early, but also when you are testing a legal assumption, like, is this legal? Is this compliant? What are the compliance sphere out there that we need to be aware of? And so like, I think it's so important, the point you made, Ida, that you need to bring in different disciplines very early. And assumption mapping actually help helps us with that, because you want to map out all the different assumptions of the different things. Like, you need to ensure that your idea, the product you are aiming to build, is something that marketing can market and sales can sell. And it's like, you can have a beautiful product people love and your sales organization cannot sell it because X and Y reason. And so you really want to test those assumptions very early. So I think that's a very important point.
On that note, thing there, I'm kind of on this roll now on this rant, is that sometimes I think a lot of teams kind of want to avoid the people who go, this is never going to work, or like, you can't do this, it's never going to work because something, something. But so when someone says this is never going to work, actually what they've done is they have identified an assumption. You could flip that around. And what they're saying is, for this to work, we would have to, you know, this or that would have to happen. So I don't think teams should be afraid of the people who are saying this is never going to work. You need to figure out, okay, you said this never would work. Can you tell me on the other side, what is it that would be need to be true for this to work? Kind of. They have an information than an assumption. And maybe you have different views on how risky it is, but at least then it's something that's you're aware of and that you can try to test or explore early rather than later on.
Very good point. I'm glad you mentioned that too. Okay, so then just to summarize it then, whenever we feel that people, that there's someone that is a bit averse your idea, bring them in, be curious, ask why. Use assumption mapping to guide what are the most important assumptions to test and the riskiest assumptions to test. Do it as a team. Now, I have one question for you, Ida. I know from all the chats we've had before that you are very strong advocate of cross-functional teams. I am too. However, I do see still a lot of people, mostly from the engineering side, that are like, yeah, but what is this discovery stuff? I don't want to spend time on this. How do you deal with that?
Yeah.
If you are a product manager or a product leader, how would you try to create this, to foster this culture of cross-functional collaboration where we're testing assumptions together? Some assumptions at least.
Well, one thing I think is like, just as I don't think that the, you know, a UX designer should be able to, you know, do terraforming or fix the backend, I don't necessarily expect the backend developer to be, you know, out in the field and doing in-depth interviews. I like the idea about, you know, where people are coming from. There's like, oh, bring your developers. But it's like, at some point, there's like, to also allow people to do the things that they're good at and in their comfort zone and contribute in the way where they find it meaningful. But then the flip side of that is also, I think that maybe people from the UX or product sometimes also have a tendency to think about assumptions or like discovery necessarily being about the user or the customer. I remember, for instance, when in Confrere, this startup where I was a co-founder, we were exploring several different product ideas to expand on our offering. And a lot of the assumptions that we identified were technical, and often they were assumptions that was shared across different product ideas. For instance, because this was in the healthcare sector, any product idea that demanded that we had to store any data meant that we would figure out, well, how can we do that in an end-to-end encrypted way? What are the, in principle, the ways you can do that? And you can look at that assumption regardless of whether it was a photo or a doctor's appointment or a video or like a message or a chat or whatever, because it's just data. But that means it's like a technical assumption. So that kind of gives and if you're also going to avoid like the analysis paralysis kind of bootstrap ends of the spectrum, it probably means that when someone more focused on user side of things should be investigating assumptions about the users, developers should maybe be looking into technical assumptions. So like not building things, but like making maybe proof of concepts, investigating what are the different APIs you might use, etc. But then when we're talking about what we're doing in the team now is to test our riskiest assumptions, that kind of means that we are working on the same thing. You know, we have the same plan, but it's just like you are more qualified to investigate that assumption. I'm more qualified to investigate that assumption. And we continuously share our progress as well. But everybody doesn't have to have like their hands in everything to be working with the team. Does it make any sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I love what you said. And something I really love to do is that, just to make it very practical, is that with assumption mapping, you can color code feasibility assumptions, viability assumptions, desirability assumptions, and even usability assumptions. And, you know, usually, like, you can see, for example, if feasibility assumptions are like blue sticky notes, you can see an ocean of blue sticky notes if you're actually struggling with a lot of technical uncertainty of, hey, can we actually build this? Do we have the right technology? Do we have this and this? And those kind of blue sticky notes, you know, you have to work together with your engineers to test those. Those are the most, you know, the better equipped people to actually test those assumptions together with you. So that's I love that, and I think this is a really helpful tool for product teams. So we've talked about analysis paralysis, we talked about the build trap, and you've had a fantastic talk on OKRs at Y Oslo. Yet another great talk. Everybody loves when you talk, either. Tell us a little bit about how can OKRs help us with focus? Is it only assumption mapping, or can OKRs actually help us with this stuff? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I guess I have to admit I'm just a radical focus fan, because I mean, the whole OKR framework in itself, I interviewed around 40 people for my book, and I didn't even know that OKRs were such a big deal at the time. We had used it a bit at the Confrere, and we had, my way into it was like somebody recommended radical focus. It just made sense to me to have the separation between the health metrics, kind of how do you keep your boat afloat? How do you know if your boat is sinking? And then the other question is, well, where are we going with the boat? You know, where are we going to sail? Like, it just made a lot of sense to me to say, like, yeah, it's important that your boat doesn't sink. Of course, I was like, but if the boat is in nice condition, we can talk about where we're going to go. And you can only go one, you can only have like one, what's the word in English? You can have more destinations, but you can only have like one course. What is it called in English? Like, yeah, you can only have one direction. There is only one direction. If you're trying to go in more directions, one, you're actually not moving. You're still. And that's also what the research says about doing things multiple things at once. It's just like you just don't get shit done because it's unclear what's more important. And then again, back to my rant earlier, is that when there are too many things that are supposedly goals or important, then people go back to those tasks again that they know how to do, you know. So all of those low-hanging fruit pickers are like, that little bug, I'll fix that bug. But, you know, it was like, I don't know if it's this one or that one, or like how to do that. And you're just like, okay, but I need to get some stuff done today. And then you work on things that are not that consequential. And then, you know, the boat's not moving, but it's in tip-top shape. So that's kind of my metaphor ended up being sort of a sailing metaphor. But now I forgot what your question was.
How can OKRs help us with focus? Because we talked about assumption mapping, that it helps us focus on the most important assumptions. So I wanted to kind of segue that into OKRs on how can objectives and key results in particular, but it doesn't need to be that, can be any other technique. How can that help us focus, basically?
The first thing, and this again is probably something I just stole from Christina Waltke, because I like her book, but is that I told people that it's probably easier to figure out what your objective should be if you have first tried to make health metrics. And again, it comes back to this word important, because usually when you talk to someone who's never worked with OKRs before, it's like one thing is going to be your objective. They're like, oh, maybe somewhere else, but it could never work here because there are so many things which are important here. And it's true that many things are important, but the thing people often conflate like something being important with it being an objective, especially in Norwegian, because we have the word we use for objective and goal and metric. It's all the same word. So it's just like too many things would be the objective, and everything is a mole. Everything is important. So, so then I use this metaphor. It's like, well, you know, imagine you have a boat. You know, what are the things that would indicate that your boat is in good sailing condition? First, let's just write all of the things that just means that we have the boat is in the shape it needs to be to even, you know, leave the harbor. And after people have been able to kind of vocalize, what does it mean that we're not like sinking or the boat is not taking water? It's easier to then have the discussion about, well, where do we want to go next? What is the like next big thing we want to achieve? Is it this thing or that thing? And then it kind of eases it for people because then we've already agreed, yes, a lot of stuff is important and we've written it down and we're going to look at it. But when you have these, and especially when people use these health metrics and they have like a green, yellow, or red level, it really helps, because then you're like, well, if things are green, I don't need to worry about them. I can focus on the one thing. But also when things are yellow or red, I'm allowed to not think about the big thing, because then other things are more important, because, you know, it doesn't matter where we're going if the boat is taking water. I'm just gonna close.
So, what do you mean by things, like, just for folks who are not so familiar with the health metrics?
Okay.
How does it work? Like,
oh, what health metrics are? So I would say you.
Just
find,
for folks, if they don't know what it is.
I can explain how I would explain it to people who haven't heard it before. So I would find maybe 2, 3, 4, maybe not much more than 5 things that somehow is saying something about things being in good shape. It's kind of vague in that instruction but it has to be adapted to your team. Like, what would it mean that your team has, the boat is not taking in water? Maybe there's something about, you know, technical depth, or the technical quality of things, you know, or is it the number of bugs? Is there some other kind of indicator? Is it something about the speed or the flow? Maybe you have something about, you know, the vibe or the stress level in the team. Because if the team is having a shitty time, they're not going to reach any goals in a way. Is it maybe something about how users... feedback or something. I mean, something that just like says something about whether things, if you're fit to take upon new challenges, or if you need to actually clean up house first. And I can give an example. So Confrere, the company I was part of, we were a tool for video consultations. And at the end of the video consultation, people could give feedback on the video call and say either like, okay, everything was okay, or like I had a bad connection, or I couldn't connect at all, or there was a sound issue. So there was like 4 categories. And what we knew is that when we had no bugs and the browsers didn't have any bugs, or like, and the different operating systems had no bugs, 80% would say everything was okay, because, you know, it was voluntary to rate. So not everybody who's happy rates, like it was always on. So we then just had established, as long as call ratings are 80% okay, we're not working on improving this thing. We just decided 80% is good enough. And that meant that team could focus on another big feature for the video calls, we were expanding the video calls from one-to-one calls to group calls, and kind of feel like a tiny little bug or something that ended in the backlog. It's okay. As long as the call ratings are still over 80% okay, we can focus on the big thing, which is the group calls. But the second it fell under 80%, you know, okay, one engineer should probably go on the logs and investigate and see what's going on. And if it fell further down, you know, everybody needs to drop what they have in their hands, because if the video calls aren't working and we're a video calling company, you know, nothing works. So forget about that next feature. This is the thing. So it kind of gives you a way to not also feel in this very awkward stretch between maintaining, you know, kind of operational things, but then also working on new things, because that's typically what you want with a product team. You want them to have this whole responsibility for the new stuff, but as well as the stuff that's already existing. But then you kind of need to give them tools that make sure they don't get like, totally burned out, because they're trying to improve everything and build everything at the same time, and just like decide what are levels this is okay. And when is it not okay? Kind of. So that's where like the health metrics and like green, yellow, red, for instance, comes in, and is actually very useful for everyone on the team.
Yeah. And when you mean the team, you mean like, let's say product trio, for those who are familiar with that term, product manager, design lead, and tech lead, and also with the engineer. So basically the whole team that is discovering and creating value. Is that it?
Yeah.
Just so it's clear. Okay.
Context for what's important or not important, or what you think, you know, like gives you one clear thing to focus on each day.
Cool. Then I would just love to, since you just talked about the product trio, I just wanted to ask you something. So I know that from all the interviews you've done, and you've covered a lot, and something I love about your work is that you've been giving a lot of local Norwegian companies a voice on how they work. And I think that is very valuable, because we are moving away from the typical Silicon Valley case study into more like a local context. How do we do product here in Norway and beyond, perhaps Europe, Scandinavia? That's something I also want to do with the newsletter I'm doing now, Scandinavian Product Newsletter. But with that said, I know you've covered a lot of different cases, and we've talked before that a lot of the companies that you've interviewed, surprisingly, they didn't have these super specific roles, some of them, like the product manager, the design lead, the tech lead, and so it seems to me also from talking with different companies in Norway and in Europe that a lot of successful companies out there, they don't have the so-called product trio, at least to some stages in their growth. However, you know, we have people like Teresa Torres, who I strongly admire too, who say, for example, I'm not going to work with this team unless they have a product trio set up from the start. So that's kind of a requirement, as far as I understand, from Teresa, for her to actually take an assignment. So what do you think about that? Like, do you think companies are better off having a product trio and it's black and white, or how do you think about that?
Well, I think I didn't know that she had like a hard criteria there, but I guess in some companies it's not formalized, you know, that they're product trio. But the real test is it like one product owner just commanding people around, or is it just like, or like, is this a team and there's like no design or user perspective or visual perspective there at all? Is that the thing? Or like, is it all just driven by, you know, engineering needs? It's much more than necessarily like a formalized trio, because that's, I know, at least from Nordic Marketplaces, which is under Schibsted, Finn.no, among others, they opted to not have a formalized product trio, but it was actually because the teams were working so well. Like, the teams were working cross-functionally and they were pulling in the relevant people at the relevant time. And then just like, sometimes it makes more sense to that this is the engineer that goes to that talker. And then sometimes it's more of the UI designer talking to the front-end engineer. Sometimes else it's like the user researcher talking with the product manager. And it's kind of like, when you have a team that actually works, like really works as a team, that formalization for the team is not so necessary. Often the formalization seems, this formalization of word in English, I don't know.
It works. I got it. I think so.
I don't know if it's an English word, but I'm like this, you know, making it explicit, let's say explicit.
Yeah, yeah.
The need to explicitly assign something as someone that designed it and that text lead or whatever. I think it's more about you need to have a team that in their totality are capable of that seeing and investigating the most common and riskiest types of assumptions that people encounter, and that they're able to, you know, investigate and de-risk them. And that's who you need to be in the room, and like how you do that. But of course, like when you come, I think often the product trios can become important when you need a sort of transformation. Maybe if you have had a very sales-led organization or a very engineering-led organization, or for that sake, a very design-led organization, you might need to have that implicit. So these three people need to be in the room, like you three need to talk to each other. Like, just like, like a middle step. Ideal would be that just like you just figure it out, but that seems to be hard for some people. And I don't know why, because I never worked on a team that didn't work. So I don't know.
No, I think that's a very important point. The artificial aspect of it that you're mentioning, it's like the roles becoming this kind of artificial theater of like, yeah, this is your area of expertise, this is you, this is you, this is you, and all of a sudden, that's just to use the word you used, like formalization or whatever, making those roles explicit becomes all of a sudden more important than actually reflecting on the things we actually need to do together. So I totally understand that. And I also agree that in some scenarios, in some contexts of transformation particularly, perhaps formalizing the roles, or at least making them explicit that, hey, these three disciplines, and I don't care about the titles, but these three disciplines need to do this stuff together. I think that sort of is the push a lot of organizations and teams need to actually start working together. And it's like, yeah, but it's part of your role, so let's just embrace it and do it. So I think that's powerful. And perhaps, and I don't want to kind of shoot myself in the foot, I do think I heard that before, that Teresa is very sort of strict with that, but also because she probably has seen so many cases, and she has concluded that unless there's buy-in from leadership to have these three disciplines available, then I'm not going to bother. That's probably why she's. But you know, maybe she'll hear this and she'll tell me it's not true.
But also, like anyway. There's the culture thing again, because again, I mean, often in the U.S. To us, they can often seem, you know, very, you know, informal, or because, you know, less so than the Brit would be or whatever, or like maybe, and they're so outgoing and social. But the US is like a lot more, things are a lot more hierarchical, more. So it's probably less likely in a US company that you would have such informal roles or informal power sharing that seems just more Scandinavian or like region, that you're just like, well, these people just like figure it out. We never gave them the title or the race or whatever. They just go ahead and do their job. It's a very Scandi thing. So maybe it's like a more necessary demand in the US context than they would be in Scandinavia.
So the more a very good
approach.
That is a very interesting reflection. And I would love to discuss more, but maybe for a next episode, Ida, we need to start wrapping up. I want to ask you, if you had to recommend one book to a product person, who would that be? Or which book?
Maybe it depends on the product, but I'm a Teresa Torres fan. It's as easy as that. I love how like the book is so full of footnotes, because I'm a nerd about footnotes as well, where she's like, everything she's saying is like documented and explained why. I really just trust it. She did the research. She's not trying to push something on you that just like some, because she's trying to build a brand or whatever. She had the questions herself. She sought them out, and now she's relaying it to us. So it's full, like, you don't have to do it exactly as she does, but you're going to learn a ton from the book anyway, just because it's just like so well researched and so hands on. And I really like that book.
Me too. And I do agree with you. Perfect for nerds as well. Okay, Ida, it was fantastic to have you again. It was very nice to see you again, and I hope we will have another episode soon.
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me. Tusen takk.
And where can people find you, by the way? Forgot to
ask. Oh, good question. I way back I had like a big Twitter following, but that's like, and you just said go. I guess it needs to be like LinkedIn or something, or send me an email, which you can find by just Googling me, because it's on my website.
Nice. Yeah. I'll have that in the show notes. All right, Ida, thank you so much. Enjoy your evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Right, that was it for today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Make sure you subscribe to my newsletter so you don't miss out, and see you next time.